good afternoon, everybody. It's good to see you all again. I spy one or two new faces. I'm not quite sure what that's all about, but it's a privilege for me to be here and talking to you again. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, just to recap in 10 seconds, we learned that not much had happened between Egypt, 3,000 years BC, and the 18th century, when anatomy took off. And once we knew how the body was put together, anatomically speaking, we were making progress for the first time in 4,500 years, essentially. We also learned that the circulation was finally established by Harvey, and Lavoisier, before he lost his head, had demonstrated that oxygen and carbon dioxide were essential for respiration. And that's where we left it, nothing to do with therapeutic medicine at all. And so here we are now, at the beginning of the 19th century. 1800 started off very elegantly. Georgian buildings were being built in London. Well-attired ladies of a certain status would travel in their handsome cabs. But by the end of the 19th century, things were completely different. The motor car had been invented. Houses that were heated and lit with gas were now using electricity for the first time. And you can see from this image a photograph taken of Place de la Bastille in Paris, of the chaos of the streets with a mixture of horses and horse carts, horse-drawn buses, and the new and wonder invention, the motor bus. So things were happening very, very quickly in society during the 19th century, as I'm sure you know. The Industrial Revolution was now in full throat, and the Romantic painters of the 19th century regarded the burning iron foundries producing in the sky at night a perpetual sunset. What a lovely image. The reality, of course, was completely different. And as you can see, the Industrial Revolution caused enormous pollution. And as it started essentially in the northern parts of Britain, where the sun rarely shines in summer anyway, you can imagine what it was like when the sky was permanently clouded with the soot from foundries and the factories that were developing. And as a consequence of all that pollution, well, people were coming from the countryside, of course, into the towns to seek work. Overcrowding was rampant. And for any of you who've taken the Eurostar from Paris to what is now St. Pancras, used to be Waterloo, coming in from the south, as you rumble in through the inner suburbs of southern London, this image will be familiar to you, and you can even see the railway line behind at the back there with the new wonder, the steam train. Overcrowding, of course, was rampant. And because of the pollution and the lack of sunlight, rickets was also rampant, which became much more prevalent than it had previously before the 19th century. Rickets, of course, we now know is a disease in which calcification of the bones of growing children is deficient, so the fibrous structure of the skeleton of the bone is malleable, and the weight of the children causes their legs to be bowed, as you can see. And this is because sunlight is an essential catalyst for vitamin D conversion in the body. In addition, you can see this little boy has got bossing of the forehead, a very characteristic malformation of the bones of the skull as the head matures in early childhood. So rickets was one of the byproducts of the Industrial Revolution to a large extent. Overcrowding led to cholera. And cholera really was endemic throughout Britain between 1817 and 1830, leading to these sort of posters being produced. Remember, nobody had any idea what caused cholera, and it was actually attributed to low morals. In order to prevent cholera, you must do the following. You must be temperate in eating and drinking. Avoid raw vegetables and unripe fruit. Probably some truth in that. Abstain from cold water when heated, and above all from ardent spirits, and, if habit have rendered them indispensable, take much less than usual. Sleep and clothe warm, do not sleep or sit in a draught of air. Remember my mother giving me that advice. avoid getting wet. The only advice that was really sensible here was attend immediately to all disorders of the bowels, because what happens with cholera is you die not from toxin, poison from the organisms, but simply from dehydration, from the diarrhea that it induces. So paying close attention to the bowels was the only bit of sensible advice in that poster. How did cholera come about? Well, we now know, of course, it's fecal contamination of drinking water or food or anything that you have in your hands that come in contact with feces. So if you will forgive me for a moment to digress on what happened to feces in 19th century Europe. And what happened was you did your whatever you did in a chamber pot under the bed, and before you went out in the morning or overnight, you tipped the contents of the chamber pot into a rather larger pot and put that outside your front door. And having done that, the night men would come around. They were known as the night soil men, and very discreetly they would take whatever you had tipped outside, put it in a bigger barrel, and would go from house to house in the street. And then the question, of course, in the absence of closed sewage systems, is what you do with the contents of the barrel. And what you do is you tip it into the nearest river, which in London, of course, was the Thames. And as a consequence of that, there were several occasions when Parliament had to be adjourned because of the stench rising from the Thames through the open windows of the Houses of Parliament. This prompted a cartoon in Punch, a magazine lamented, it disappeared now, but was prevalent for many years in Britain, as you know, and you may have read it yourself. Faraday was the leading scientist in Britain during the 19th century, and here is a cartoon in Punch, Faraday giving his card to Father Thames, suggesting that perhaps Faraday had the answer for this terrible business. Another major epidemic of cholera occurred in London in 1854, and this occurred in Soho, where the local physician was John Snow. And John Snow was one of the early scientist physicians, and he wanted to understand where the cholera epidemic was coming from, what was causing it. And he did a very careful survey, and let me just show you what he observed. What we're looking at here is a 19th century map of London, and in the map, just for those of you who are familiar with the city, we'll recognise Oxford Street here, Regent Circus, and what we now call that Oxford Circus, Regent Street coming down, here's the Crescent going down to Piccadilly Circus. And this area, with all these little black areas, black marks, is Soho. And he meticulously plotted out, house by house, where a case of cholera had occurred. And he looked for a common link. Bad morals didn't really do it for him. And he was looking for something else. And what he came across was, in fact, the common link was the water pump, which I showed you just a moment ago, in Soho, in Broad Street, which was contaminated with the organism causing cholera, and hence it all spread. And I think John Snow rightly should be regarded as the father of epidemiology on the basis of that remarkable observation. And there are the organisms, Vibrio cholerae, responsible, which we weren't to know about until 1850, 1880, when Robert Koch, who we'll be talking about in a moment, made this discovery. In addition to cholera, typhus was rampant. Typhus is a mysterious disease which seems to have disappeared. It presents rather like influenza, but with a rash, which influenza doesn't. And characteristically, there's a sort of altered mindset. People become very drowsy and disorientated, much more than with a regular fever. Very characteristic, but it commanded a very substantial mortality, and it is thought that Albert, Queen Victoria's consort, died from this very condition. It spread very, very easily by contact, and with overcrowding, of course, like cholera and sewage water mixing with food and drinking water, overcrowding was easily, the core easily enabled typhus to be spread like wildfire. And consequently, it was very common in military barracks. And it is said more soldiers died in Napoleon's army from typhus than from wounds sustained in battle. Not only was overcrowding the norm for soldiers in barracks, but of course the workhouses were rampant in 19th century England. Overcrowding was rampant there, and many of these youngsters and their parents succumbed from typhus in overcrowded conditions, as did prisoners in prisons. Another disease, which was rampant and had been for millennia before, but is now mercifully almost on the way out, was tuberculosis. Now, tuberculosis was curious in several respects. Firstly, it was the number one cause of mortality of young people, young adults in Europe for much of the 19th century. It also had a slightly romantic connotation, because if you suffered from tuberculosis, you developed a cough, you may have coughed up a little bit of blood, but as the disease took hold, there was a quiet withering of the body. And you can see from this painting here by one of the Pre-Raphaelite painters that the languid appearance of the lady in the green there on the left, you can see she's got sunken cheeks, having lost a substantial amount of weight. And because of the periodic fevers that accompanies tuberculosis, there is a transient flushing of the cheeks, which is very romantic. At least it was perceived as an ideal of feminine beauty. What an extraordinary thing to say about a lethal disease. But it wasn't all that bizarre, because death from tuberculosis usually was a fairly tranquil affair. You just became weaker and weaker and just faded away. And this was much beloved, of course, of the romantic poets, many of whom succumbed, if not from syphilis, from tuberculosis themselves. There was also a slightly erotic connotation to tuberculosis among women. And those of you who are familiar with Puccini's La Bohème will remember Mimi succumbed from tuberculosis, as of course did Violetta in Verdi's La Traviata. In the last scene of the opera, she falls into the arms of Alfredo and finally fades away. Another disease that was quite prevalent but much more mysterious was neurasthenia. Now, neurasthenia, of course, doesn't exist in the medical curriculum today, but it was very common in Victorian England particularly and in France, and it affected, unlike the virgin's disease we talked about in the Middle Ages last time, young unmarried ladies, this typically affected married, well-to-do ladies who basically had nothing to do. And as a consequence, they were tired and languid and would faint periodically. And the treatment for this was to go to a spa, and the more expensive the spa, the more effective the treatment. Another disease, so-called, less well-known, well-documented, was nymphomania. And nymphomania was affected only women in a man-orientated society, as I'm sure you would understand. And it was attributed to, if I may quote, overeating, obscene conversation, and an unfortunate choice of novels. Its treatment, however, wasn't quite that amusing, because it often ended up with cautery of the labia and extreme recalcitrant cases, clitoridectomy. What a terrible business. Another product of the Industrial Revolution, of course, was a completely new array of diseases, the industrial diseases. Now, Percival Pott, physician at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in the 1700s, had recognized what he called sweeps scrotum. And what this was actually squamous cell carcinoma, cancer of the skin of the scrotum, which occurred almost exclusively in chimney sweeps. Why? Because in those days, coal fires, you had to work your way up a chimney to get the brush up and often send somebody up as well, somebody smaller and slimmer than yourself. And of course, there was no running water, a bath or a shower to be had when the chimney sweep got home in the evening. So of course, he was completely black from head to toe. And when he did his ablutions, he didn't take a shower as a coal miner would today. He simply took off his outer clothes and washed his hands and face, and that was it. And it was not appreciated that the carbon that is soot is actually carcinogenic. And the last part of the body to be washed, of course, was the genitalia. And so the scrotum, over many, many years, would actually develop squamous cell carcinoma. So that was documented 100 years before. But with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, a whole new array of industrial diseases came about. Most notably, of course, pneumoconiosis from the coal miners who were digging their coal for the smelters, for the iron foundries and powering the factories. Silicosis from the knife grinders, the sandpaper they were using for grinding would produce silicon particles which they would inhale. Asbestosis for people who were in the building business at the time. Asbestos was used as an insulator. Cotton workers. The cotton mills, of course, were the engine, apart from the iron foundries, of the Industrial Revolution. And cotton dust produces fine particles which were inhaled by the workers working in very close proximity without any ventilation. And they developed a condition called brown lung, which is a form of chronic fibrotic pneumonia. And so on. Lead poisoning was very common, not only among plumbers who were used to using lead, not appreciating its toxic effects, but glaziers as well as painters, because most paints contain lead as well. So you can see a whole array of diseases that hadn't existed before were now upon us. Things we haven't talked about, therapy, because there wasn't any. But in the middle of the 19th century, things began to change. And here we see progress for the first time, given the anatomy and the early physiology of the earlier century, but therapeutically speaking, things began to change. And what was instrumental in that, particularly in Great Britain, was in 1854, the Medical Reform Act was passed by the British Parliament. That sounds a bit dry. But what it was requiring anybody who practiced medicine to be a graduate of a university or a medical school, pass an examination, and be granted a government license. Now we take that for granted. So before this Medical Act was passed, it was a free-for-all, basically, and hence all the quackery and everything else. This was a monumental advance in the same way that in the 20th century, socialized medicine came to much of Europe, a monumental advance, the government taking responsibility for healthcare, which in the country I'm privileged to live in at the moment seems completely foreign. But I have to say that we've got change in the wind. The family doctor, therefore, came into being and replaced the friendly apothecary to whom you went. So here we now see the beginnings of modern medicine, thanks to that one act, which was then duplicated throughout Europe. Hospitals were being built or renovated. They'd been in existence for several hundred years, but were basically just repositories for the sick where not much was done. And here we have a lovely, fine lithograph, hand-coloured, of a new ward in the Middlesex Hospital, which alas is no more under the National Health Service rationalisation of the London teaching hospitals. The Middlesex Hospital is now just a building site in the middle, just off Tottenham Court Road. But this was a great hospital in its day. And what was unique about this hospital is that patients were segregated not only by sex, but by disease. And remember, at that time, in the 1850s, making a diagnosis wasn't that easy. But nonetheless, tuberculosis was recognized because of its clinical pattern. Typhus, diphtheria even, was being recognized. And so patients were being segregated according to disease so that the physicians who were attending upon them would have a number of patients of similar condition from which to make their observations. And that was a very rational and I think an important advance in its own way. Clinical medicine was advancing, but not in Britain, but interestingly in Paris. And here we see Martin Charcot in Paris, who was the renowned clinician of his day, listening to the back of a patient, can you see with his ear there, and looking eagerly over the end of the bed. This is at Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, and this is a painting taken of this occasion, his eager assistants and students watching a clinical examination. Isn't that lovely? And what he's doing is listening to the breath sounds of the patient. Now remember that anybody who came in with a respiratory condition, if it wasn't something easily self-limiting like bronchitis that got better on its own, was almost certainly tuberculosis until proved otherwise. And in tuberculosis, it usually affects one lung rather than the other. One of the reactions to the focus of tuberculosis in the lung is to engender fluid formation in the membrane that surrounds the lung, called the pleural cavity. And Charcot had observed that his local publican was in the habit of percussing the beer barrel to determine the level of the beer in the barrel. And it happens, if you listen, you percuss over your chest, it is resonant where there's air, and where there is fluid, it is dull. And here was Charcot passing on that observation he had made, and he had just percussed this patient, and now he's listening to confirm the absence of breath sounds where the fluid had waterlogged the lower lobe of the lung and there was no aeration. This was a monumental advance, considering what had happened before. No stethoscope yet. But at the Necker Hospital, some 20 years later, here we have Lennec, who thought it would be easier than put your ear to the chest to develop some acoustic tube, which was in fact just a simple tube of wood with one end open, the other almost occluded with a small opening, which he put to his ear, and there you have the first monaural one-eared stethoscope. So things are beginning. It's beginning to look familiar. And shortly after that, chemists, of course, had been using thermometers in their laboratory for decades. The first clinical thermometer really came into use in about 1860. So all this is all very new and wonderful and important. Although licensing was important, a lot of people still, quackery still continued, and one of the favourite self-remedies, because going to a doctor was expensive and time-consuming, and also you weren't sure whether what he might do because of the memories of what doctors did in the old days, patent medicines were rampant. And this is what happens if you take universal vegetable pills, which in Britain were the favourite thing to buy over-the-counter for all sorts of maladies. And this is a cartoonist's impression of overindulgence in vegetable pills. There was still a lot of cynicism, because we haven't really had anything, we can't really talk about anything therapeutically beneficial yet. We've talked about clinical advances, yes. We've talked about organisational, professional advances with licensing, yes. We knew anatomy, we know a little bit of physiology, but in terms of therapy, we were still absolutely useless. And so, not surprising, in addition to the vegetable pills, there was a resurgence in Hanahan's homeopathy that we talked about yesterday. This was a burgeoning movement in Europe because of the nihilism of medicine, therapeutically speaking, and also led Mary Baker Eddy to found the Christian Science movement, thinking that perhaps that we had strayed too far from God and that this would help us get better. So here we are in 1850 then, with licensed, 1900 now we're coming up to, the family doctor had a completely new concept. For primary care physician, we would call him now, but family doctor I much prefer. And the family doctor would come to the house, be a respected, revered figure. I remember myself as a child when the doctor came. This was a great occasion. The best tea service was put out for him. You remember, I'm sure. There was an aura about a respected family physician. Here he is. But bear in mind, he had nothing to offer for diabetes, nothing to offer for hypertension, nothing to offer for infections, nothing to offer for arthritis, nothing to offer for a stroke, coronary, let alone cancer. All he could offer was his presence, which had an enormously powerful effect, which I remember from my childhood, and I'm sure you do too. He came in, he sat, he put his hand on yours or on your child's head, and above all, he listened. Would that that would be the case today. 1850, at last, medicine advances in a useful way. And to this, we owe an enormous debt, enormous is an understatement, to four great men. And the first, of course, was Louis Pasteur, 1850s. We ought to know a little bit about this man, because without Louis Pasteur, we would still be in the Dark Ages. Louis Pasteur was a French chemist. He was born in the French countryside. His father was a tanner, and he trained as a chemist. And his particular interest in chemistry was that of fermentation. And he made a chance observation. He used to have a culture medium for his yeasts to study the chemical products of yeast and how he could modify them. And what he observed, that one night he had left open a flask of his culture medium, and in the morning it had become cloudy, whereas the glass flasks, which he normally closes with a stopper, were clear. And at this time, microscopy was coming into its own, and so he took samples of the cloudy broth, and how, I don't know, given the size of bacteria, he recognized in the broth tiny, tiny, tiny particles, which he called microorganisms. And now, of course, we now know these as bacteria. And this observation set in train the whole therapeutic armamentarium we have for treating infections. This one simple observation. And he made the observation that if you heated the broth, or heated the organisms, they disappeared. And this led to the pasteurization of milk, of course. Remember, at the time, there was no knowledge of microorganisms, but it was well known that milk spoiled, as did meat when left out. But the prevailing theory at the time that this was a spontaneous generation of something which caused the decomposition of milk into cheese, and spontaneous decomposition of meat leading to the production of maggots. It wasn't appreciated that flies had come and laid their eggs, and the maggots hatched accordingly. So here was a revolutionary concept. There was something in the air that enters something and causes spoilage. He went on, abandoning his chemistry, he went on to discover, this is a later stain because he didn't have stains available, but this is a magnified view of streptococci, the organism responsible for septicemia that carried so many people off following a prick or a rose thorn, and you would die 5 days later of the massive fever of sepsis, streptococcus. He identified later streptococci, staphylococci, pneumococci, the organism responsible for bacterial pneumonia. But he was laughed out of court, and nobody really believed him. He was also, because he was from farming stock, his father being a tanner, living in the countryside, he was particularly interested in the diseases that affected both man and animals. And the two that came to mind to him were rabies and anthrax. And he had read of the effect of smallpox inoculations, and had developed himself in his later years antibodies, a vaccine for anthrax, and also, less effectively so, for rabies. So what a monumental chance observation that changed his whole direction in life and opened up the whole world of therapy for infection. He was still not accepted, and it was Robert Koch, who in the latter part of the 19th century was professor of public health in Berlin, who knew of the work that had been done, and himself was able to demonstrate that Pasteur was absolutely right. Furthermore, he was able to demonstrate that each infectious disease was caused by a specific organism. It wasn't just organisms cause disease. And he got a Nobel Prize in 1905. Alfred Nobel's legacy came into being in the form of a prize in 1901. He was the fourth recipient of the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine for his discovery, not only the confirmation of Pasteur's Streptococcus, Staphylococcus, and Pneumococcus, but also Meningococcus, and particularly the organism causing tuberculosis. Before his recognition of the organism causing it, it was assumed it was an autonomous wasting disease. And there we were, the organism causing tuberculosis, the biggest killer of young people in Europe throughout the century. He went on to do other things that were equally important. He added to Pasteur's broth gelatin, and this allowed him to spread the broth out on a plate, and taking some pus from an infected individual, plate it out, on a little swab or a stick, and that allowed the individual organisms to grow on the surface, and he noted that different organisms had a different morphological characteristic on the plate, and this helped him identify what the organism was. A major, major advance. And Koch's monumental contribution was the elaboration of his four postulates, which are still taught to medical students today. And he stated, because of his observation and experimentation, number one, a specific organism is present in every case of a specific disease. Number two, that when you find the organism in a particular disease, it is only that organism that's present, no others. The specific cause of disease. You then take the organism and you give it to an animal, and that animal catches that disease, it's transmissible. And that animal that has now acquired that disease, you take the pus from that animal, and it's exactly the same as the one you originally had. So in other words, this was absolutely rock-solid evidence of the specificity of the bacteria causing infection. And there was no other explanation. And this finally put the last nail in the coffin of the generationist theory that decay and disease just the things that just occurred spontaneously. Nothing of the sort, of course. It was bacterial infection, transmissible infection. He also went on to develop a diphtheria antitoxin, which was the first antitoxin that could be used for a disease, knowing that by giving diphtheria to horses, horses didn't catch diphtheria, but their body produced a chemical which appeared in their blood, which could then be used for treating patients. And here you see horses that have been inoculated with diphtheria. They are well, but here we are some weeks later. A needle is passed into one of their neck veins, blood is collected, and then the red cells, the blood cells, are separated, and the serum is then used, which contains antitoxin. And this was the first treatment for diphtheria, which before polio was the great dread of mothers when their children were sick with a sore throat. And indeed, it did have a very high mortality because of the inflammation in the throat, which restricted breathing, and these babies died, children died a respiratory death rather than a toxic death. In his last years, what a man, he went off to Africa and discovered that it was the tsetse fly that was responsible for the trypanosome causing sleeping sickness. He is in his pith hat, which was de rigueur at the time when he went to Africa, looking down his microscope. The third great man was Robert Rudolf Virchow, who was professor of pathology in Berlin, I think one of the first professors of pathology, a completely new speciality. Virchow knew that a Frenchman, Bischoff, who was a pathologist, who was a physician who carried out numerous autopsies in Paris, had recognized that in disease, when he did his autopsy, he found that very often certain organs in the body looked abnormal. So here was disease affecting specific organs in the body, a new concept. Virchow also knew that Schwann, a German physician looking down a microscope, had recognized that organs comprise numerous cells. And Virchow made a deductive leap from those two observations and was able to say that disease arises in the cells of the body. It's the cells that are pathological. And this was a new concept as well, because cellular anatomy was something that was unknown. Organs were organs, but here we are. Disease actually affects the cells. And he went on to plot meticulously through his microscope the changes in cells. This is an actual sheet from his laboratory notes, looking at diseased organisms through the microscope for the first time, recognizing pathological changes in the cells that had never been thought of before, let alone recognized and described. He was also the first to diagnose leukemia, simply by looking at the blood cells and recognizing that these great big blue cells were abnormal lymphocytes and acute lymphocytic leukemia, the background being the red cells, which were normal. His laboratory was renowned throughout Europe, and was a mecca for youngsters wanting to learn about pathology, and so the whole new discipline of pathology was born. The fourth great man was Claude Bernard. All of these people within 20 years, can you imagine? We've had 3,500 years of nothing. And in 20 years, we have four great men who have revolutionized the whole approach to disease and medicine. Claude Bernard was a failure. At least he thought he was a failure. He was born in Villefranche in the south of France, a lovely little Mediterranean port town, I'm sure some of you may know. And he wanted to be an actor, but more than an actor, he wanted to be a playwright. And he wrote numerous plays, but try as he may, he could not get any of them performed. And his family said, you really need Claude to do something else. So he shrugged his shoulders and says, well, I'll have a go at medicine, which was really he became, of course, professor at the Sorbonne and president of the French Academy. Why? Because he was a thoughtful man. He had respected the humoral theory of the body, you remember, blood, yellow bile, black bile, phlegm. He was brought up on that because, after all, there wasn't much to replace it. He was aware of Descartes' mechanistic theory that the body was really a machine, and he was trying to reconcile the two things. And he came up with the concept that the body requires an even, balanced internal milieu in which to function properly. The milieu internal had to be in order. In other words, balancing the humours. But instead of looking for black bile, yellow bile and phlegm, he was now looking at the newly discovered sodium, chloride, potassium, glucose, oxygen. So there we were, full circle in a way, but this time an informed closure of that circle. And this was really the beginning of physiology. Experimental physiology started with Claude Bernard. He recognized the pancreas produced digestive juices and could demonstrate what they actually did. He demonstrated that the liver contained glycogen, which was really glucose stored and could be reactivated when needed to produce sugar in the blood and give instant energy. All of these things were a balance of this internal milieu, which is exactly right. And what an advance, yet nothing is new. And here we are, thousands of years later, but now putting it on a truly scientific and meaningful basis. Clinicians, great clinicians, abounded as well. And here is Pierre-Louis at La Pitié Hospital in Paris, who was the first to do clinical demonstrations. And I remember as a student at Barts Hospital in London, going into a lecture room rather similar to this. And our neurologist, Aldrin Hendren at the time, a distinguished European neurologist, would wheel in a patient with myasthenia gravis and would demonstrate that by fatiguing the muscles, the patient became paralyzed, and then with rest, the patient could get up and walk again. And this is exactly what Pierre-Louis did in Paris, the introduction of clinical demonstration to the students of the patients and the salient points to make an accurate diagnosis. What an advance. All this in 20, it's just mind-blowing, isn't it, in 20 years, how all this came about. What was going on in America? We regard America as the sort of source of everything nowadays. But remember, in 1860 or so, America wasn't even 100 years old, and the Civil War was just about to begin. So in 1870, 1880, American physicians got wind of what was going on in Europe with these monumental discoveries, and they sent a delegation. And that delegation comprised four individuals. It comprised Walsh. It comprised Holt. Walsh was a pathologist. It comprised Holstead, who was a renowned American surgeon. It comprised also Osler, a renowned American physician, and Kelly, a renowned gynecologist. And these four individuals traveled to Paris to watch clinical demonstrations, to Berlin to learn about pathology, and they traveled to Vienna. And there they went back to the United States and founded in 1889 the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Isn't that interesting? In addition to those four great men, there were other people who made a big difference as well, and particularly in the field of military medicine. Here we have Dominique Jean Larrey. Dominique Jean Larrey was in a way a successor to Ambrose Paré, of whom we spoke yesterday. You remember this statue of a very thoughtful surgeon who had been 30 years the chief medical officer, chief physician to the French army at the time. And so was Larrey, but he was Napoleon's chief medical officer of the army. And throughout Napoleon's campaigns, he was thinking, what can he do to better the lot of wounded soldiers? And he was a great man, hardly recognized. He recognized, he established, first of all, field first aid stations, which was unknown of in battle. If you see the great Hollywood movies of these great epic battles of the Middle Ages, you got stabbed with a lance or an arrow and you just lay there and that was it. You either got up and walked home or you died. Larrey instituted first aid squads to go to the aid of the wounded. He then organized a mobile transportation, the first ambulance system, to bring the wounded behind the lines where they could receive better care. And because of Napoleon's disastrous campaign to Moscow in the middle of winter in 1812, he made the observation that you could carry out amputation completely painlessly if the limb was frozen. An interesting observation. A great man. He was also very compassionate, I might say, and it did not matter whether it was a French soldier or an enemy soldier, they were treated equally. What a great man, who deserves recognition. The other person, of course, who made a tremendous difference was this lady, Miss Nightingale, named Florence because that's where she was born. Her parents came from Derbyshire in England. I'm not quite sure how they ended up in Florence, but she was born there and named accordingly. But her family was very well connected. And when they returned back to Britain, the Crimean War was raging. The Times newspaper was known as the Clarion, and it was very accusatory of the government and its incompetence. And dispatches were being received from Crimea of the dreadful conditions of the soldiers on the battlefield. There were no medicines, few bandages, hardly any bedding, no ambulances, no first aid. They were just left there. And she was appalled by what she read. And through her connections, she was able to work her way to Crimea. And there she saw exactly what the situation was. Soldiers just left as they were. They are either escaped injury, were killed outright, or just left to fester with their wounds. She would have none of it. She was a religious girl. She'd had a vision in early age, a bit like Hildegard of Bingen, that she was put on this earth to do good for her fellow men or women. And she organized transport of the wounded soldiers across the water to the British base camp in Scutari. And there she started a hospital, having gone back to Britain meanwhile and recruited 38 like-minded ladies of London who came with her back to the Crimea. And as a result of that, a parliamentary commission was appointed to look into the conditions there. And she was able to secure everything she wanted. Medicines such as they were, bandages, bedding, and care was given to these soldiers. What a remarkable lady. Remember, until that time, there was no such thing as nursing. You were basically a prostitute or a bar maid who did a bit of something on the side to earn a bit of extra money. And she was the one who turned nursing into a respected profession. When she retired from her Crimean duties, she went back to London and founded the first school of nursing in Europe in St. Thomas's Hospital. What about surgery? Well, you could freeze the leg, as we discovered from Larrey, in the outside Moscow, but for practical purposes, there's not a lot you could do for surgery, mainly because there was no anesthesia, there was no asepsis, there was no real knowledge up until the 1850s and 60s and 70s of bacterial infection. There were no blood transfusions, so what you did was really limited to something superficial that seemed fairly safe. But the first observation was made about infection and surgery by this man, Ignaz Semmelweis. Now, Semmelweis was a physician at the Vienna General Hospital, and he made an observation about the time that Pasteur's work was just becoming known about organisms. It was very much at the time, how much he knew, I don't know. But he made an observation, and that is, in the obstetric, or the midwifery department of the Vienna General Hospital, where women were being delivered, they were in two different wards. One ward was administered, the care to the mothers was given by midwives. And the mortality from puerperal sepsis, which is what carried mothers away in childbirth, if not in obstructed labour, which we now know is usually streptococcal infection causing septicemia, because of all the bare area with the separation of the placenta, the body is very vulnerable and prone to that. He had recognised that on the ward where the babies were being delivered by midwives, mortality from puerperal sepsis, as we now call it, was very low. There was another ward where the great obstetricians would come. These were the great men who knew everything. And there, the mortality was devastatingly high. And Semmelweis wanted to know why the difference. And it turned out that the midwives, being good mothers and housekeepers when not being midwives, were in the habit of washing their hands. The men, the great men in their frock coats, had just come up from the autopsy room and delivered the babies. And that simple observation led Semmelweis to recommend that chlorine be used in water to wash the hands. And for that, he was actually hounded out of the Vienna General Hospital for having the arrogance to question the great obstetricians. This is the chart that he actually produced to make his point. It was compiled looking at mortality. This is before Pasteur, so I correct myself, before Pasteur. He didn't know about microorganisms, he just made this observation. And here we can see the mortality. The bottom axis is the calendar year, 1841, 42, 43, 44, divided into the months, which you can barely read, no matter. But up the vertical axis is the percent of patients who died. Look at those figures. 30% of women died in childbirth in 1842. And here, the chlorine hand wash was introduced in 1847, and the mortality fell dramatically. No knowledge of bacteria. This preceded, I knew it was somewhere in there, and this reminds me, this preceded Pasteur. So no knowledge of what was causing it, but there was the evidence. This was published, and eventually Lister, James Lister, Regius Professor of Physic in Glasgow University, some 20 or 30 years later, had made an observation among English farmers. And when their animals grazed themselves against the posts or the fencing and got what looked like infection of their skin, he would bathe that in chlorine, but in carbolic acid. The farmer would use carbolic acid, which was used for some other purpose, I know not what, but if the farmer put carbolic acid on their wounded animals, the animals got better. And Lister had admitted to his service in Glasgow a 14-year-old boy who had been run over in the street by a cart. Now, it doesn't sound too worrying, a fractured bone, big deal, but remember, no sewage and everything else, and the streets were absolutely like a cesspool. And this boy had a compound fracture and normally would have gone straight for amputation. But Lister, knowing about what the farmers were doing, thought he would try something different, and that is on the wound, on the legs themselves, having splintered the leg, where the wound was, he bathed these in dressings soaked in carbolic acid, dilute form. And he had these dressings changed several times a day for 6 weeks. And at the end of 6 weeks, the boy walked out on his own two legs. He wrote this up, the first case of antisepsis, if you will, in a case report in The Lancet, the year I have recorded somewhere, if I can find it for you. It was, I think, in about 1870 in The Lancet, the first case report of antisepsis with a benefit. And Pasteur was just recognizing organisms. So it's all beginning to come together. Hadn't quite come together yet, but there was the evidence for the antisepsis. And it was some years, just a matter of another 10 or 20 years until a physician in Birmingham Hospital thought, why kill the organisms once it was recognized that bacteria were causing the infection? Why kill the organisms once they've already occurred? Why not prevent them in the first place? Working on the principle that Pasteur had demonstrated that you could kill organisms with heat, So we now have sterilization for the first time coming in as a byproduct of Lister's observation. Isn't that interesting? All within a tight compress of 30 years from total ignorance for 3,000 years, and here we are with glimmers of the modern era. What about anesthesia? Well, there was none, of course. You just a swig of whiskey and four strong men was your anesthetic up until 1880 or so. And here we have a painting of the first anesthetic to be given in the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and I think this was in about 1840, 1850 or so, or thereabouts. And here you can see what we would now call the anesthesiologist at the head of the patient holding a flask in his hand, and this was the flask of ether that was used for the first operation. This is an operation taking place in about 1840. Not in an operating room, but in a lecture theatre, rather like this, the patient sitting in a chair, being given the ether, becoming unconscious, and here is the surgeon in his frock coat with a scalpel, doing something in the neck, one would suspect removing a tuberculous lymph node for biopsy. I would suspect that's what the operation was. Prior to ether being used, a couple of years earlier, the chemists who had been busy, remember Lavoisier was a chemist, discovering all these things, the whole field of chemistry was opening up. Chemists had discovered a very simple molecule, nitrous oxide. And when experimenting with nitrous oxide in the laboratory, they became a bit woozy. And they had discovered, in fact, the anesthetic properties of this gas that they had discovered or made. And the wooziness was actually quite comical, and they really found it very amusing to be woozy on nitrous oxide, and it became known as laughing gas. And it enjoyed a great popularity in fairgrounds. And a fair stall holder would have some nitrous oxide, which he somehow acquired, I know not how, and people would come along and pay their penny and take a whiff and fall about laughing. True, well documented, hard to believe, but it's true. But what was remarkable is when they fell about laughing, some of them fell badly, and yet they got up, it didn't seem to matter. So there seemed to be an anesthetic property to this, as well as a sort of hallucinatory effect. So nitrous oxide was really the first anesthetic, but it wasn't terribly effective, but it was taken up by dentists, and even to this day, there are dentists who still use nitrous oxide for this purpose. Ether followed it very quickly. But ether, although effective as an anesthetic, produced a lot of mucus and was very irritative, and you coughed and spluttered as you tried to inhale this. It was difficult. So it was chloroform, which followed a little later, a few years later, that became the anesthetic of choice. And the chloroform was popularized when Queen Victoria took chloroform on the advice of her physician for the delivery of her fifth child, Prince Leopold. And there he is in her little Prince Leopold is the baby there with her siblings. And she wrote in her diary, the day after the delivery on chloroform anesthesia, in her diary, the effect was soothing, quieting, and delightful beyond measure. 7th of April, 1853. Isn't that lovely? Surgery could now advance, because with anesthesia, you didn't have to rush to remove a stone from a bladder in a minute, or amputate a limb within 2 minutes before your patient died from shock. So now with anesthesia, surgery could progress. And for the first time, the abdominal cavity was no longer out of bounds, because it took time to enter the abdominal cavity, do what you had to do, and come out. And you couldn't do this without anesthetic. The great surgeon of the latter part of the 19th century was, in fact, Bill Roth, working in Vienna at the Vienna General Hospital. And it was Bill Roth who pioneered the first operations on the stomach for cancer and for ulcers, as was the commonest cause for gastrectomy. He also did nephrectomies, removed the uterus, removed ovaries when necessary, closed the abdominal cavity, the patient asleep throughout. And as antisepsis was coming in at the time Bill Roth was working in the 1870s, 1880s, antisepsis and asepsis was beginning, we now began to see more major operations and better survival, fewer infections. So we're getting now into the modern era. The gastrointestinal tract was still out of bounds because of the bacteria that contained, and if you tried to do a colectomy and join parts of the colon, there would inevitably be the spillage of fecal material, and infection would be an absolute guaranteed outcome, and without antibiotics that would have a very high mortality. So the gastrointestinal tract, other than the stomach, was out of bounds, but just about everything else was now permissible, thanks to asepsis or antisepsis and anaesthesia. Appendicectomy became very popular around 1901, particularly in Britain. Why? Because Queen Victoria died after a long reign, having come to the throne in 1837, and in 1901 she died, and her son, who had been waiting in the wings for decades and decades and decades, King Edward VII, was coming to the throne. He immediately became king upon his mother's death, but his coronation was planned a little bit down the road. The British do these things in great style, as you know, and the preparations take quite a time. And a week or two before his coronation, he developed acute appendicitis. The coronation had to be postponed. A surgical area was prepared in Buckingham Palace, and he was operated upon by his surgeon. And the next morning, his surgeon went to visit him, and the king was sitting up in bed, very chirpy, smoking a cigar. It seems to me unlikely he had his appendix removed. I think what had happened was he developed an appendiceal abscess, and that the surgeon had simply made a little incision, stuck his finger in, and all the pus had come out, and thank you very much, the king was feeling much better. It didn't seem quite consistent with that well-documented observation. What about pharmacology? Well, there wasn't any. Remember we had a long discussion about Dioscorides and the Egyptians and Thutmosis, all the botanicals that really formed the pharmacopoeia in ancient times, right up until the 1850s or 1880s or so. There was, the way medicines were given, there were a few things of therapeutic benefit. We learnt about jacona bark, you remember, brought back by Columbus, containing quinine, beneficial for malaria. I didn't mention willow bark and the reason for giving medication. Willows grow by water, usually northern climes, cool water, and so willow bark, when powdered and given to a patient, would be given to cool a fever. Why? Because the water somehow has a cooling effect. So there was an association. And in the same way, if you had jaundice, you were very likely to be given an extract of yellow crocus. And that was the thinking of the time, without any real understanding of chemistry. But the willow bark was, in fact, like the chicona bark, it actually contained salicylic acid, or as we now know, aspirin. And aspirin turned out to be, and I think still is, the most widely used and probably most universal beneficial medication in terms of patients administered worldwide for the last century. It's a remarkable drug. It is an analgesic, so you take it for your headache or back pain. It is an anti-inflammatory, so it soothes arthritis or inflammation. It is also an antipyretic, so it will reduce your fever. And we now know it has some anticoagulant properties, and small dose of aspirin is frequently recommended for those who've had coronary artery insufficiency. A remarkable drug, given by chance, but it turned out that there's a therapeutic basis for that. Real pharmacology only began, though, with this man, Friedrich August Kukulé, who was a chemist, who made a monumental discovery, and that is that chemicals, where chemists had been working in the century before, were not just letters joined up on a sheet of paper, but were three-dimensional structures. And that organic materials contained what we see here to the left of his head here, a hexagon, which is a benzene ring. Now, don't get too excited about the chemistry, it doesn't matter. But he recognized that organic materials always contained a benzene ring. And a benzene ring chemically is carbon attached to a hydrogen, and this goes round in the hexagon. Very simple molecule. And this opened up the whole world of organic chemistry. He didn't know any therapeutic application of this. He was a pure chemist. But this one observation led to the whole development of an exploration of this family of chemicals to see what properties they might have. And so, having recognized that willow bark contained aspirin and salicylic acid, and the formula could be identified, so chemists became interested in looking at a number of other organic substances to see whether these may have some therapeutic benefit. And what they observed was, where do you find benzene? Of course, in coal tar oil. Petroleum is rich in benzene. In fact, we even call diesel fuel benzene, or in German it's benzene. So the chemists then started to distill benzene, and by distillation I mean they put some benzene crude oil in a jar, as you can see here, warm it so the volatile vapours come off the solid, pass down the neck of this tube into this flask, and you can see a tap running. And the tap is to cool the flask. As the warm vapours reach the flask, the cooling condenses them and a clear liquid forms at the bottom. And this liquid is then analysed. And it turned out that this liquid contains some simple molecules which in fact, therapeutically, are very beneficial. The company that pioneered this is the Bayer Corporation in Germany, which is still very much thriving today. And from the coal tar, they were able to distill paracetamol and phenacetin. Now, phenacetin was the aspirin substitute up until 20 years ago, when we realized that it had a bad effect on the kidneys, and it's since been withdrawn. But paracetamol, developed in the late 1890s, is still widely used today. And in fact, in America, it's known as Tylenol, in England, Panadol. I'm not sure what it's known as here, but it's still regarded as the most widely used and safest of the analgesics and antibiotics that we use today. All thanks to Kukulé, who recognized the benzene ring, the Bayer physicians who organized the distillation process and made an analysis of those volatile products, and so we have phenacetin and paracetamol. Notice, in addition, in their publicity, little thing here that will be in a pharmacy, not only aspirin, but heroin. And heroin was widely available. You could buy it over the counter. And it was developed because the manufacturers and physicians were aware that opium was addictive. Opium was a very powerful analgesic, of course, refined as morphine. But opium smoking was rampant throughout Asia. And indeed in Europe in the 17th, 18th and early 19th centuries, it was a romantic thing to lace your tobacco with opium. And you would have opium dens and poetry and all sorts of wonderful things would come to mind. But it was addictive, so the chemists wanted to modify the opium molecule and render something less addictive. It was also known that opium, as a byproduct of its effects, would suppress cough. And so the manufacturers wanted a non-addictive cough-suppressant form of morphine, and they came up with heroin, which we now know is to be vastly more addictive than morphine itself. But that's just a little aside to show the vagaries of the pharmaceutical industry. And there you can buy your heroin quite freely, but now, of course, not. Now, I left yesterday with the story of the York retreat, do you remember? And this inspired Quaker, who wanted to do good for people with psychiatric disorders. And I said, I will tell you what happened. Well, I'll tell you what happened. He was picked up immediately by this man, Philippe Pinel, in Paris, who read of York, the York retreat. He may even have visited Turk in his retreat to see what he was doing, treating psychiatric patients, not with restraint of all sorts of bizarre methods of shaking up their brains to make them normal, so to speak, but by treating them with kindness. And Pinel thought this was a wonderful idea, and he acquired a large house on the outskirts of Paris, well, way out in the countryside, in fact, where he gathered a lot of patients, and here you can see all sorts of patients, obviously somebody having a fit on the floor there, somebody against the wall there in chains, and he would go to established mental institutions and order the chains to be released, and he would take them to his retreat in the countryside outside Paris. He treated them with kindness. Restraints were rarely used, only in cases where patients were mutilating themselves or harming others. But by and large, no restraints. They were treated with kindness, fed well, and given things to do, working in the laundry, working in the fields. And the question is, did this have any benefit? Well, no harm came to them, I couldn't say, but it didn't, of course, make any difference to their various mental conditions. So, sadly, a wonderful idea, a humane idea, but therapeutically not really contributing anything useful. So what happened, let me just go back for a second, what happened to the mental patients then who didn't benefit from the York retreat or Pinel's lovely house in the countryside? They were basically abandoned in the streets, left with their family. Family care was the idea. And of course, if you had an unruly, retarded relative or somebody who was living in your house, there would become a time when things were intolerable. And so you would have to put that individual somewhere. And there grew up, particularly in London, a whole industry of for-profit, privately owned madhouses. And that is where you put your retarded, handicapped, psychiatrically ill relative, or eventually your mother-in-law. You know. They ended up in these institutions. You paid them, but at least it got them off the premises. The problem, of course, there was no medical care involved. This was really just a roof over. It wasn't so much a roof over their head, but just keeping them out of sight. And of course, there was tremendous abuse. So much so that questions were raised in Parliament about what was going on, and a parliamentary commission was appointed, led by John Freeman Mitford, seen here in his full regalia, Speaker of the House of Commons in the 1820s, and he was also Chancellor for Ireland. And his commission was charged with examining the crimes and horrors in the interior of Warburton's private madhouses in Hoxton and Bethnal Green. Warburton was a great landlord who owned many of these houses. And as a result of that, a government commission was appointed, a Health Act was passed by Parliament, closing all these down, and it was thought prudent to put all these patients now with the burgeoning knowledge of physiology and medicine, put them in a specially designed mental hospital where they could be studied and helped. And so now we see the historic Bethlehem Hospital in London, which is now rebuilt in this magnificent manner here in the 1850s to house the patients who were rescued from Warburton's and other madhouses. But the problem was there was no diagnosis, and who ended up in these hospitals was just about everybody who was not quite within the normal bounds of society. So you had people who were mentally retarded, people who had had strokes, people who were aphasic, epileptics. You had social outcasts, you had the florid psychoses, you had true mental disorders we would now call bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, unrecognized at the time and certainly not labeled. But a hodgepodge of everything, including such misfits as homosexuals and chronic masturbators. And so it is not surprising that when you had everybody thrown into an institution together without any attempt even at diagnosis, let alone treatment, that it was a complete hodgepodge. And this in turn turned out to be a failure. So it's a sad story for psychiatry, even up to 1900. This is a lithograph by Hogarth from 1700, which illustrates what happened in mental hospitals in the 18th century in London. You can see all sorts of people represented, somebody with a clown's hat on, somebody sitting there, somebody with a book on his head playing a violin, somebody imagining himself a king in the doorway there, somebody pulling his hair out, somebody else playing with some strings, somebody looking, imagining he's Galileo looking through his telescope there, this poor fellow in the back looking like he's in a trance or prayer, I know not what. And such hospitals as they were then, and even into the 19th century, were a popular place to go on a Sunday afternoon to look at the mad people. It was an entertainment. What a terrible, terrible situation. So, I don't want to leave you on that pessimistic note in psychiatry, but I will, as I did. I left you on an optimistic note yesterday with the York retreat. A pessimistic note now, but things brighten up tomorrow for the budding psychiatrists among you, I promise.